in Italy. The parents of this 22-year-old had a friend who was involved in such bitter divorce proceedings in England that they offered to house his daughter for a few months before she was to return to Oxford later that fall. She couldn't have been happier than to be spared the daily riot in her parents' home, where quarrels, insults, and objects thrown around the dining room made her life intolerable. But the student, as everyone would find out in less than a few days after she'd settled in their home late that spring, was hardly more tolerable than her parents. She was uncommonly impatient and harsh with the help in the house, and her speech and behavior downright offensive with everyone, including her uncle, her mother's brother, who took her blunt manner in stride and put up with her insolence whenever she criticized or mocked their home. She had taken the bad habit of practicing her violin in their living room for hours on end, which made family life impossible past mid-morning. Her morning snack was always left half-finished in the living room, and her coffee mug left round stains on one of the wooden cabinets. But worse of all was her attitude with the young man in the household. She contradicted and argued with everything he said and made no effort to hide her contempt for him. One evening, just a few days after she had moved in, she watched him walk into the living room to bid his parents goodnight. He was on his way to a dinner party and was wearing a new suit. She looked him over, smirked, and said it was clear the suit was purchased off a rack somewhere. His tie didn't agree with his shirt. The shirt was too bright, the sleeves too long, and the jacket too wide. Had he, perhaps, purchased expecting to put on weight in the years to come? He was humiliated. "These are no better," she said after he'd rushed upstairs and taken off the suit, shirt, and tie she'd derided and put on other clothes. He disliked her, no less. What particularly irritated him was the way she was so visibly enamored of herself. Every time she passed by a mirror or a dark glass panel, she could not resist casting a lingering look at herself, always checking her shirt, her hair, her face. Sometimes when she spoke with someone, it was clear her eyes were not focusing on him, but on her face in the mirror. He was no better. She couldn't stand his snobbish airs each time he attempted to play master of the house when his father wasn't present. It was clear to everyone that, once he'd passed the bar, he'd manage his father's affairs and eventually inherit his business. It was also very clear that he resented her presence and wanted her and her violin gone long before she was due back to either one of her beleaguered parents. That summer he was cramming for the bar, and the last thing he needed was an intruder upsetting his quiet home rituals with the perpetual droning of her instrument in their living room. Worse yet was her horrible habit of humming with her violin, sometimes literally singing along with the instrument. His mother tried a few times to speak to her about the sound and recommended she practice in another room far from where her son was studying. So here he was, studying for the bar, and there she was, singing along, almost as though doing it on purpose. So finally, one day he decided to take matters in his own hands and asked her to stop practicing while he was studying. She asked if he would stop studying while she practiced. "Well, he had an exam," he said. "And so did she," she replied. Then she should practice in her own home, not in his. They had a loud row, at which he blew up and told her that she was not his sister and that this was not her home. "Besides, you're not even your parents' daughter," he added, with a heavy note of sarcasm. "Meaning what?" She repeated the word with derision tearing out of her voice. "Meaning exactly what I've just said." She seemed puzzled. "So you didn't know, did you?" he finally asked. "Didn't know what?" He was not the type to mince words with her, and told her that she and her parents didn't have a speck of blood in common. That her parents, who were second cousins, had more in common with each other than with her. "You, dear girl," he said, "were adopted. No one knows who brought you into this world, so you are what is generally referred to as a mongrel." This shut her up. She was certain that he had made the whole thing up to hurt her. But as happens with unexpected revelations that suddenly seemed to put everything in its place, his words had come with a ring of truth, and what was more surprising yet, didn't seem to upset her. As though she had always suspected, but hadn't had the time or the means or the will to consider the matter further. But what surprised her even more than the revelation itself was the feeling of total relief that accompanied what she'd just heard, as if she had finally found a good reason to be rid of parents she'd wished to shun since childhood. She'd always had a strange hunch that she never belonged to them. But where that hunch was born, she had no idea. Still, this did not mean that she was going to accept the news from him. She yelled the loudest, "Liar!" anyone had ever screamed in his placid household, and after slapping him in the face, asked him to give her one iota of proof. "You don't need proof. Your rage is proof enough," he replied. No woman had ever slapped him before. It spoke her sudden helplessness, and he liked having driven her to it. Seeing him smile after the slap sent her spiraling into a fit, and she was about to scratch him on the face, except that he grabbed both her wrists and asked if it wasn't time for her to start practicing her fiddle now. "You monster, you shithead." Then she got a hold of herself. "This news, for your information, is nothing new. The only difference now is that you're the shithead who's dotted the I's for me. Now leave the room." "No, you leave." She walked straight away out of the living room, slammed shut the door behind her, muttering, "You beast!" This is what she'd heard her mother exclaim to her father, neither of whom, as she'd just found out, was either her mother or father. "And good riddance to the whole lot of you," she yelped. But later that day, thinking back on what he had told her, he realized he had gone too far. He knew now that she had every reason to hate him. He could already tell she hated everything about him, from the way she grimaced when he read verses out loud to his mother, or the way she sighed each time he rubbed his hands with sunblock, just his hands, before heading out to the beach. He could see it in her eyes, or when she grunted when he thought he was saying something profound while watching the news. Plus, he always had his set habits, and always needed to be the first to read the paper when it arrived in the morning. Everyone else in the family read it when they had a moment, sometimes long after lunch or later in the evening. He was stuffy and fussy, and he seemed to know it and liked being that way, which is why she cut him down on the evening he had put on a suit before heading out to dinner with friends. She hated the way he rattled the car keys, hated the sound of his shoes when they hit the parquet floor, hated his laugh, even. She even hated his horrible habit of pruning the skin off every mandarin segment of every orange or grapefruit because he didn't like the skin of fruit and would leave their naked sloughs drying on his plate like the shed skin of baby reptiles. He even wanted his tomatoes peeled, ditto with potatoes and cucumbers. There was not a thing she liked about him. Now she wanted him dead. And he could read it on her features. It amused him, as if he wanted her to hate him, because he too enjoyed hating her. When his father asked him to apologize to her for something he had said, he refused, saying he'd never apologize to someone like her. He'd said this because he had heard his father ask her to apologize to him for something she too had said, which might have hurt his feelings. Her blunt reply was unforgettable. "I don't know how to apologize." Yet despite their recent rows, and there were many, both were discreet enough not to let on to his parents how much they scorned each other, or that he had told her the truth about her adoptive parents. At dinner, the two of them were well behaved. "Could you pass me the salt?" "Of course. Here it is." This the day after she had called him a beast. At breakfast, when they were seldom alone, they greeted each other with a seemingly hearty, "Good morning." And when watching TV with the family on the evenings when neither was out, they always shared the same sofa. When they crossed each other either on the way in or out of the house or in the empty corridor, he would whisper, "Asshole," and she would whisper back, "Shithead." Once on the stairs, and without meaning to, he accidentally elbowed her rather hard, while she right away kicked his shin with the point of her sneakers. He yelled in pain. "Teaches you," she said. Then when she happened to trip against a cinder block in the garden, he couldn't help exclaim, "Hope it hurts." But when he saw her bleeding from her wrist after she had cut herself against the slightly protruding large pointed leaf of a forged iron table in the garden, he rushed to fetch a spool of gauze from one of the medicine cabinets and applied rubbing alcohol generously on the cut before wrapping the gauze tightly around her wrist three times. He couldn't decide which had given him more pleasure as he helped staunch the bleeding. Proving useful in a moment of need and showing his expertise in treating a wound, or watching her reaction once the alcohol burned her, You did it on purpose, she said, referring to the alcohol. He smiled all the while, applying pressure to the cut with his thumb as he tied the knot around it. I did, he said. There's no need for so much alcohol. At least you won't need stitches. I'm not an idiot. Meaning, any idiot could tell that stitches weren't needed. Well, you are an idiot. And left her in the garden with a bottle of alcohol and roll of gauze for her to return them to the medicine chest. Right, she replied. Don't let me hold you up. But he was already gone and out of hearing. Later that same afternoon, when she was lying on the beach, he passed by with a glass bottle of cold water. Can I have a sip of water? He heard her say. I forgot to bring my own. Without thinking, he threw the bottle on the sand next to her. She was not unaware of his contemptuous gesture, but was thirsty enough not to show any sign of anger or say anything about his manner. She simply brushed the sand off the bottle, removed the cap, and took a few sips. Then, seeing that some sand had landed on her towel as well, she brushed it away, then raising her eyes, looked at him and made a gesture to give him back his bottle. Why do you hate me? She suddenly asked. He did not have time to think of an answer, and simply tossed the first answer that came to his mind. I don't know. But you must have some idea. He shrugged his shoulders. Do you know why you hate me? She shook her head, meaning she didn't know and didn't care to know either. Or even then, I guess. She asked him if it was normal for the wound on her wrist to throb. Yes and no, he replied, but said he'd need to take another look. She simply raised her wrist to allow him to inspect it. He cautiously wrapped the bandage he had made hours earlier, compared her right wrist to her left, said it wasn't swollen or red, and cupping her wrist in one palm, asked if this hurt a bit. You did it on purpose, she said after he had pressed the wound a tiny bit. He did not allow himself to answer her accusation, but recommended she use the antibacterial ointment found in the medicine cabinet in the guest bathroom. He let go of her wrist, stood up, and was all set to walk away. Didn't you want your bottle back? She asked. Keep it. He said these words with his habitual dismissive inflection whenever speaking to her. You didn't have to hurt me, you know. I didn't mean to, he replied. Why don't I trust a thing you say? I may be a complete shithead, smirking as used her word, but I'm not a psycho. She looked at him and said nothing, but it was clear she was mulling a sharp and cruel rebuke to his perfunctory apology. You don't think this could lead to sepsis, do you? She finally asked. I've seen worse cuts. He offered to get her the ointment. Don't bother, she said. Suit yourself. And with this, he walked away. The next morning at breakfast, how is it? He asked. Better. And this was all they said. He read the paper. She reviewed the Bakshakon. He spoke to his mother. She spoke to her uncle. On the beach, when she was lying on her stomach with her bikini top off, he came up to her and, kneeling down, asked to see the cut. No need, she snapped. He stood up again. I was just offering. I can tell it's doing better, she replied, sensing that perhaps she had been overly brusque with him. But take a look if you have to. I promise I won't touch the cut. And here I was looking forward to having the wound pinched, maybe even squeezed. I told you I wasn't a pervert. No, you said something else. I was only echoing your word. It made the two of them laugh. You know, she said, we really have no reason to hate each other. I'm not a bad person, and I'm sure you aren't either. He decided not to argue. Would you do me a huge favor? Though it might totally deplete today's ration of superficial goodwill. What? I can't use my wrist. Could you put some sunblock on my left shoulder? He grabbed her tube of sunblock and began rubbing her right shoulder with it. Wrong shoulder, she said. I know, I want to cover both, so you don't look ridiculous with an uneven tan. I know how important your looks are to you. But as he was spreading the suntan lotion on her skin and then on her back, he didn't mind her skin. The more he applied the cream, the slower and more lingering his hand motions. What are you doing? She finally asked, sensing right away something different in his touch. Just spreading the sunblock, he replied. But then he asked her to raise herself just a tad, and without hesitating, began to apply the cream on her left breast, then her right breast. So they don't get sunburnt, he said, smiling. She did not say anything, and simply followed with her eyes the slow, tempered motions of his palm as it caressed, and kept caressing her breasts. Then, looking down at his bathing suit and sounding totally surprised, simply said, "Oh, I see." He did not say anything, but kept caressing one shoulder, then the other, back to the first, then to her breasts, long after the cream had been spread and was fast drying in his hands. Then he reached for her tube and began applying more cream to his hands and then to the back of her neck and her bare back and the back of her arms. "What are you doing to me?" she asked. Yet again, he did not reply.
"What are you doing to me?"
he finally said. Again she looked, which is when she suddenly managed to lift herself, put back her bikini top as best she could with one hand, and rolled up the towel she had brought with her from the house. She stood, and leaning down with the knees almost touching his chin, picked up her magazine, sunblock, and sunglasses, and headed home. But her words, "What are you doing to me?" wouldn't let go of him, and resonated in his mind all morning as he lay stunned on the deserted beach. He suspected she was upset with him, but he also knew that, behind the veil of reproof in her words, meaning, "How dare you do this to me?" her voice could have cradled an inflection of desire, astonishment, possibly surrender. "What are you doing to me?" No woman had said this to him before, and the strain in her voice when she'd spoken these words cast a spell that wouldn't let go of him as he lay there unable to think or read or even focus on the quiet July waves rippling to the shore. He could think of nothing but the breasts of this woman he hated. Then almost suddenly, he realized what her words had also stirred in him, for they were neither docile, nor vulnerable, nor moved by anger or even passion. They were savage. She was savage, not angry, not passionate. The way she had rolled up her towel and decided to put on the bikini top despite her wrist and exposed herself in the process without embarrassment, the way she had snubbed him after looking and smirked was sudden, shameless, and yes, savage. Many hours later, when it was time for dinner, he ran into her on her way downstairs to the dining room. Were they really going to push each other again as they'd done a few days earlier? She made a motion to let him pass by flattening her body against the curved wall of the staircase in a gesture that showed she was determined to avoid another shoving bout, even though both sensed that shoving after what had happened between them on the shore belonged to the past. But then he had done the exact same thing. By thrusting his body against the banister to let her pass, he too was suggesting that insults between them, let alone their habitual elbowing, were no longer something either wished to pursue. He read her exaggerated move to the wall as yet another instance of her overly theatrical nature, since he knew she was entirely driven by external gestures. A reading of his own move against the banister was far more accurate. "He is nervous," she thought. "He likes me." "Why did you touch me at the beach?" she asked as they proceeded down the stairs. She was expecting an answer. Instead, she got a question. "Why did you let me?" This did not please her, and he could tell she was about to turn mean again. "Are we always going to be enemies?" he asked, hoping to stem the tempest before it erupted. He had rehearsed that question and thought it was as good a way to bring back what had happened between them at the beach that morning. "Are we enemies?" With that, she rushed downstairs to dinner. His heart was fluttering. She's lying. She couldn't possibly mean what she'd just said. Just before walking into the dining room where a guest and his wife were present, he found a moment to tell her that he couldn't believe a word of what she'd just said to him. She smiled. "I know." He couldn't help himself. "You know that I shouldn't believe you? Or do you know that I don't?" She looked at him again the way she'd just done and repeated, "I told you, I know." No one in his life had puzzled him so. Everyone else he'd met was transparent, even when they tried to remain elusive. "Do I scare you this much that you need to speak to me in riddles?" She thought for a moment before greeting one of the guests. "It's not you I'm scared of." "Of whom, then?" "Of whom, then?" she mimicked. "It's me I'm scared of. Me, you understand?" He was totally baffled. "Now you know." Not a word between them throughout the dinner. After dinner, she managed to catch him on his way upstairs.
I'll come to your room.
When? He asked.
I don't know.
That night, he could not sleep. Each time anything in the house creaked, he was sure that she was opening his door. But then he realized that she was not the furtive type to go about the house on tiptoes to open doors softly. Besides, he had left his door ajar, something he'd never done before, precisely to let her know she was welcome in.
Why hadn't she come, then?
Perhaps she had made her promise on the fly and had just meant to tease him with never a thought of going through with it? Or perhaps something he had said right after dinner had made her change her mind? Or had she simply fallen asleep and forgotten?
Sensing she wasn't coming, he resolved to make himself dream of her.
And perhaps he did dream, though it wasn't exactly a dream, but just like a dream, during which all he did was revisit time and time again what she meant at the beach when she'd said, "What are you doing?" And moments later, once he'd rubbed her breasts and began to massage her feet, the heel, the arch, and then the toes, and in between the toes of each foot, he'd heard, "What are you doing to me?" she said. And in his dream, all he replied was, "You know exactly what I'm doing. Of course you know. You've always known." And then came the moment he savored most, but kept postponing each time he saw it coming from the periphery of his dreaming mind and enjoyed deferring as much as he could so as to arrive at it after many delays. The moment which he knew had happened when she had suddenly turned before standing up to leave the beach. Oh, she'd seen, all right. And he liked that she'd seen. How couldn't she have? Because this, too, was true about the two of them. They cared for each other so little as to harbor no shame, no qualms, nothing to hold them back, which is why he had touched her, and why she'd let him, and why she'd seen, and he was pleased that she had.
"You never came last night," he said to her the next morning.
"Did I say I was?
I just wish you had. I never apologize."
He refused to speak to her. When he went to the beach later that day, he made a point of lying far away from her. But then one morning, after he'd resolved never to give her another thought, he woke up and found her sitting on his desk chair staring at him.
"How long have you been there?"
"A while."
"Just staring at me sleeping?"
"Yes."
"Why?"
"Because I can learn so much about someone by watching him sleep."
"What did you learn?"
"I learned that you can be a very sweet man, but your sleep is not happy. You clench your jaws and you look angry sometimes, as though fighting demons."
"Maybe I was thinking of you then."
Then realizing what he'd just said, he felt he needed to say more.
"All I do is think of you. I go to sleep thinking of you, dream of you, and wake up with this."
He wanted to shock her. She wasn't shocked.
"Seriously?"
she said.
"And then one day I open my eyes and I find you in my bedroom."
He moved to the side of his bed and lifted the sheet again, clearly inviting her to his bed.
"No,"
she said. She did not know why she'd said no so gruffly, but she also enjoyed turning him down.
"You don't trust me?"
"I already told you, it's not you I don't trust." And having said this, she left his room. But a few nights later, he didn't have long to think before deciding to slip into her bedroom. Not knowing what to wear, he decided to put on his bathing suit. Her clothes were lying on a chair, so he plopped himself on the low wooden cabinet that housed the family's sewing machine and simply sat on it and watched her sleep even though it was getting colder by dawn.
"What are you doing?"
she said when she finally opened her eyes.
"It's my turn," he said.
She did not say anything, just looked at him and at his bathing suit.
"Are you planning to swim in my bedroom?"
They both laughed.
"I haven't decided, but I'm cold and this swimming suit at this hour is utterly ridiculous. I didn't know what to wear."
"Aren't you cold?"
"Freezing."
Using her feet, she pushed her sheet away and exposed her naked body.
"I've been thinking of you."
She didn't have to add another word. He removed his bathing suit and, shivering, crawled into her bed. She hugged him, kept him warm with the weight of her body, and placing the palm of her hands on each side of his face, said,
"I'm so glad you came."
From that moment on, as under a spell, the two were as inseparable as Tristan and Isolde. What neither realized was
was that all their bile and venom and their contempt for each other was precisely what allowed instant intimacy to spread upon them without their sensing, much less suspecting, that it had already happened. It didn't flourish, it didn't blossom, it simply sprang on them that day on the beach when he'd thrown his water bottle next to her on the sand and then touched her skin. Because neither even thought, much less wished, there could be anything between them, they let their bodies decide, not their hearts, not their minds, not even the thrill of secrecy from everyone in the household. For all they knew, their one night together was going to happen once and once only. But it was because they expected nothing, not even pleasure, that they couldn't let go of each other. This, as she, the Bach student, explained one day, was intimacy by contrario motu. They backed into each other's life and spent the remainder of that summer making love every moment they could. They never asked why they made love, but they made love without holding back, because at least at first they didn't seem to care what the other thought or felt or needed. What cleared their way was not friendship. It was enmity fooled them. They lasted 4 months until October. She wanted to give up Oxford. He wanted to follow her there. They were smart enough to know that nothing lasts, least of all fiery passion. But they lay naked every morning on their rock. They made love every afternoon and every night. And sometimes they'd end up at the movies, interested in nothing and no one except each other. There wasn't a thing they didn't do together. She once asked him if this was real. Does any of it not feel real? He'd answer, no. So why ask? Because we need to ask. Because we need to know. Because I fear the worst. If you're going to England, I want to be on the same plane with you. If you're ever on a boat, I want to sail on it. If you're crossing the street, even, I'll walk with you. She died in a car accident not 5 miles away. She had just turned 22. There was bad light that night. The twisting roads along the cliff were slippery, and the fog dense. He should have stopped her. Something told him, though, the moment he remembered that they had never once, not once, used the word love. That's how he suddenly knew that something was amiss. The thought wouldn't have come to him otherwise. But he didn't trust himself, and chose to overlook the signs. I can do many things, Raoul said. I can cure someone's back pain, let kidney stones dissolve into nothing, make tempests happen, stop boats from sailing. When I was a boy, I could make the school bus arrive late at school, have parking spaces suddenly materialize so my father wouldn't get upset, even have the food ready long before we stepped into a restaurant or had even ordered. But this was beyond me. He was quiet for a moment. One day, I told her, we could lose interest in whatever we have and be back to hating each other, ramming each other up and down the stairwell. But then, she said, I'll hurt myself, and you'll tend to my cut, and before we know it, you'll slip into my bedroom wearing that swimming suit, asking to be kept warm, and we'll swim out to a rock and make love there till dawn catches us freezing. Do I remind you of her? Were you thinking of making love to me when we were on the rock together? Margot asked. You don't understand. What don't I understand? I did make love to you on the rock, except it was 40 years ago. Her name, as I'm sure you've guessed by now, was Maria. But looking back now, it was I who died, not she. I who've been dead my whole life, except she is you, and you are more alive today than I've ever been. Margot heard him say this and bristled. It made her entire life feel like a fraud, as though her life as Maria, if indeed it was a previous life, took precedence over everything she'd lived, known, and done. She wasn't prepared to accept this shadow self, she said. Please don't be angry with me. It was not my intention to belittle your current life, or to ask the previous one to compete with it or take it over. All I wanted was to be with you. For a few hours. For a few days, that's all. He paused for a few seconds. Before we leave this house, which you may never want to see again, at least not with me, and certainly not when I'm alive, I want to show you something, he said. What? She asked. By now she'd grown restless and hostile. He did not tell her what. Instead, he led her up to the stairs to the first floor. This is the famous stairway, he said, knowing she'd understand. And then up to the second floor. He opened the door to a small room. I know the smell of that room, she said. I know that smell. It was once your room. You do know what stood here, on this very spot. He could tell that she had already guessed, or rather, had always known. She did not have to say. Correct, he replied. And I want you to see this, he said, opening a closet. We saved it as a keepsake. But I kept it knowing you'd be back to see it one day. He took it out of its case, then unwrapped its felt covering. May I? She asked, meaning to touch it. It's yours. You can take it now if you wish. Seriously? She asked, as she rubbed a palm delicately on its glistening maple back. Very seriously. But I've never played. He smiled. But why are you giving it to me? It's the only proof I have that you are who you are, that you are back. You see, you didn't die. You just went away. I can't take it. Well, think about it. Promise? It's yours. She nodded. I also want to show you something else, he said. What now? He overlooked her tone and opened the other cupboard door, which revealed a linen closet. He put his hand under a thin sheet of cloth lining one of the tiny shelves filled with folded tablecloths and colored napkins and pulled out a square envelope from underneath. He opened the unsealed envelope and produced a colored snapshot of a young man and a young woman wearing bathing suits. They're both smiling broadly and squinting a bit, probably because of the sun in their face. In the distance lies the rock. She's holding a plastic bag while attempting to hide it behind her back. Her hair is short. The two of them are very tanned. Maria? Margot asked. Maria, he replied. She looks like me. She is you. We even have the same knees and the same feet. Same elbows, he added, as she raised her elbows to take a better look at them. She agreed. The two of you look so alike, she said. I know, sometimes we felt we were the same person. So you've kept this photo? Of course I've kept it. It's the only picture I have of the two of us. Who took the picture? Someone. What's in the plastic bag that she's trying to hide from the picture? You know the answer. Fruit. She just rinsed it in the seawater. Again, Margot stared at the picture. Take it, said Raoul. I can't take it, it's yours. It means more to me now if you take it. Plus, I hate when you do this, plus what? There's a reason why I want you to have it. He waited a few seconds. I want you to remember the face of the young man in the picture. Why? You'll meet him when you're my age. You make the rest of my life feel so joyless, so totally pointless. She gave what she'd just said some thought. Just take me back to our hotel. Together they left the room and walked down the old stairwell. Chapter 6. On their way, she walked much faster than they'd done earlier, either in a rush to get back to the hotel or determined now to show that she was keeping her distance. He was not surprised. She had to shower and change, she said. Her friends were planning a night out at one of the clubs in the hills. He bid her good evening, and they separated in the lobby as she entered the elevator. But then suddenly she stepped out again. All manner of hopes raced through his mind when he saw her step out so swiftly and was sure he had totally misjudged her. With a simple gesture, she removed her sweater and gave it back to him before rushing back into the elevator. Later, when he walked into the dining area by the pool that was all illuminated, her friends hailed him. Malcolm was asking if you had any more tips for him, said Basil. All out of tips tonight. Send him my apologies. Oscar showed him his new hat. My newest conquest. Raoul congratulated him. And the shoulder? he asked Mark. Couldn't be better. She did not greet him, but continued to chat with Angelica. Nor did she even turn to look at him, though he could sense she was fully aware of his presence at the table where barely a few hours earlier he'd had one of his happiest lunches in so many years. Strange, he thought. She didn't used to be so chatty with everyone. Now she was all ebullient and sprightly, talking to Oscar, to Mr. January, Miss May, and Mr. November far across their table. I've lost her, he thought. For the second time in my life, I've lost her. There was a moment when they were lying on the rock together, like the most intimate of lovers, friends, sister souls. He knew that she'd felt it as well, that moment. But life can sometimes take the most perfect day and ruin it. If life doesn't do it, then we'll be the ones to do it. This, now, he could tell, was indeed ruined. On her way out of the dining area, she passed by his table and stopped short right by the chair where she'd sat during lunch. Against all expectations, he was momentarily led to believe that she was actually about to sit at his table and pick up where they'd left off at lunch. Instead, she just stood before him, even placed a hand on the tablecloth, but wasn't saying anything. She looked so pinched that he expected her to strafe him with a volley of cutting words. But she wasn't saying anything. Perhaps she was waiting for the others to leave the area before talking to him. But even after they'd left, she still wasn't speaking. He simply looked up at her beautiful face. He, too, had nothing to say. What she finally said could not have jolted him more. You could have warned me about the car that night. You could have warned me. Why didn't you? Because I couldn't believe it could happen. Because I thought I was being unreasonably paranoid. Because I just didn't want to think of it.
You didn't want to think of it. That's some gem, Raoul.
She tapped her knuckles on his table twice, as if to nail her point home. But she wasn't leaving yet. And for your information, she added, I still remember the accident. I remember the sound in the car, and the sound of the bones breaking in my body, and I remember not dying right away, too. He couldn't believe where all this was coming from. Oh, and one more thing, she said. It was not the road, not the fog, not the swirling eddies of rain that kept buffeting the hood of our car. Your driver was drunk. You hired a drunk driver. Why hadn't you told me?
I wish I'd died with you in the same car, he said. We'd have been spared all this. Now we have to wait.
Spare me, please.
With this, she put on her windbreaker and heard the call of her friends who had ordered three cars. One of the cars was already honking. Again, a moment of silence between them.
So, should I get in the car, you think? She asked.
He smiled at her.
Yes, it's safe.
Good night, then.
Good night, he echoed.
He didn't quite understand what she'd meant by that question. Was she pulling his leg and making light of his prophetic powers? He wasn't even able to interpret the word then that she'd just used. Was it an amicable, conciliatory then that came like a friendly nudge of the elbow after strong words? Or did it underscore the chill, ironic cloud between them? And as always with Margot or Maria, something unavoidably hostile and dismissive. A few moments later, she returned.
And one more thing. If you had anything to do with our boat, maybe it's time you released it.
She had given everything he'd said more thought than he'd imagined. That bit about their boat, which he'd thrown in as an afterthought when talking about gallstones and back pains, hadn't escaped her.
So you understand everything, then, he thought of saying to her.
He heard the cars leave the hotel and feared he'd never see her again. That night he did what he'd done so many nights before. He took out a cigar, found himself a chair and a table, ordered a strong drink, and sat down and smoked. Nothing to read, he didn't want to be distracted. Nothing to listen to, music would blur his thoughts. He just wanted to think of the young man who'd entered a girl's room in his bathing suit and sat there, waiting for her to wake up and share the warmth of her body. The cigar took forever to smoke. Then at some point, he decided to stub it out, finished his drink, and opted for a walk along the shore. He left his glasses on the table, removed his shoes, rolled his trousers, and proceeded to walk to the shore.
"Isn't this what those who are about to take their own lives do when they leave a note in their shoes on the edge of a bridge?" "Why on earth do people remove their shoes, but not their socks?" he thought. "And what about their wallets, their watch? Why punish a watch that stayed loyal to you all life long?"
It made him want to laugh. He heard himself snickering. What he couldn't quite fathom was why she always got so angry the closer he got to the truth. The more he convinced her she was Maria, the more she bristled. The violin was hers, so why hadn't she taken it? Now that she knew he hadn't lied, now that she recalled the accident, recalled the sound of the car tumbling down, with the sound of her body breaking, and the drunk driver whose body, so they said, fell not just out of the car but down into the sea, never to be recovered again. "Se l'hanno mangiati i pesci." The fish ate him, they said. But he couldn't let go of the moment when she came up to his table, placed a palm on the tablecloth, and asked why he hadn't warned her of the accident, as if it had all been his fault. And to bring the point home, he rapped the table twice. He'd never forget that gesture, followed by a smiling then, as if she'd meant no harm, as if peace were never in doubt between them, as if war and peace were, in the end, identical bedfellows. Then there was that other moment, when she had swum with him to the rock and he'd helped her up there with him. What a beautiful moment, to make the gods envious. Of course they were envious. That night the walk on the shore took him to the spot where the old lighthouse used to stand. He saw it now not as he remembered, or as Alberti had captured it less than a decade after the war, but as she had described it. A squat little hut made of stacked boulders with a strange round attic-looking structure from which scant light emanated to warn mariners of rocks and shoals. Her words, exactly as in the photo. Later, when he was back in his room, a strange thought kept buzzing in his mind. He was pleased that they had spent time together, yet on second thought, now that they'd been together, there was little left for him to do. He had waited so long for this, and now it had come and gone. "Come and gone," he repeated to himself. "Come and gone," he whispered out the words to himself as he brushed his teeth a while later. "Come and gone," as he read a few pages before sensing he was about to doze off. "Come and gone," when he was finally about to turn off his bedside light and thought about his own life that had come 6 decades ago and would soon be gone. "And why not?" he thought. "And why not?" Then he heard the knock at his door. "I knew it. I'd always known," he thought. "Come in." She was dressed in exactly the clothes he remembered her wearing when she'd stood before him and placed a hand on his table. Same blouse, same sweater, same necklace, same way she'd arranged her hair. Only her lipstick had faded. "Finish the story," she said, removing her linen shawl and sitting on the armchair that was close to his bed. He made a motion to turn on the main light in the room, but she told him not to. "The story," he said with a melancholy smile. "They wouldn't let me see the body. A few days later, they wanted to take away her things and her clothes, but I didn't let them. Everything in her room stayed the way she left it. When I revisit the town, I always make a point of going upstairs and stepping into her room. I'll sit on her bed, think of her. There were times when I've flown all the way from Peru to sleep in her bed. Those are the only times in my life when I sleep ever so soundly. Sometimes I speak to her. Sometimes I imagine what she'd say. 'I've grown so old,' I'll say. 'Yes, you've grown old, and you do look old, my dear, dear man,' she replies. And I'll ask her if she remembers the rock, or the cut on her wrist, or the sewing machine. And she'll say she still does, of course she does. And yet we never used the word love. Why is that? Maybe because it was more than just love, or maybe it was something else. But it never went away, and I don't want it to. Still today, that one sentence she spoke to me 40-some years ago, 'Were you planning to swim in my bedroom?' brings a smile to my life." Raoul couldn't see her, She sat slightly behind him, and he liked it that way. There was a moment, given the silence that suddenly hovered between them, when he felt that perhaps she had already slipped away and left his room, or had never even been there. "Why did you come tonight?" he asked. "Because you wanted me to. Because I really didn't want us to drift away. Because I could tell you weren't happy, especially after such a lovely day."
"So now we read minds?"
"I had a good teacher." "But finish the story," she said, tucking both feet under her thighs on the armchair that was so close to his bed. He told her that he'd always kept an eye on her as she was growing up, had tried not to intrude, but knew where she lived, which school she attended, what college she was applying to, who were her friends and roommates. He kept hoping she'd pick up the violin, but she never did. "And honestly, part of me was waiting for you to get older."
"Older than Maria?"
"Yes. Otherwise, I doubt you'd have spoken to me, much less had lunch with me."
She shook her head lightly, as if to reproach him for something she had no words for, so just the gesture would do.
"Why not let go of me? Forget, let the whole thing just go."
"Can I, now? Especially after today? Can you?"
"I'm gonna try."
"Don't you think I've tried? Do you have any idea how happy you've made me? Mine wasn't bereavement, I wasn't in mourning, I wasn't even sad you died. I was just missing half my body, half my life, maybe all of it. I ended up living another man's life, not mine. I was no longer me, and yet I was a master at faking it with everyone. For years, each time I was alone, in the shower, or getting dressed, or in bed when I was alone in bed, or in the kitchen cutting up vegetables by myself on a Sunday evening, I'd mutter your name, Maria, out loud, and feel completely ridiculous doing so, and yet still happy that this name existed in my life, that I could call it, and by calling it, even talk to it, as I'm talking to you now. At some point I realized that I just had to see you. Not to relive what had happened 4 decades before. All I wanted was to have you with me, for an hour, for a day. More, I never dreamed of asking."
"And?"
"I could have waited more time, as I'd been doing for so long, letting another 5 weeks, 5 months, 5 years go by. But my time's almost up. And this now is the hardest part for me, telling you what lies in store for me. For me, the matter will be settled very shortly. I laugh at what awaits me. New parents, new schooling, new siblings, and the years and years of our crossing paths and never stopping, or occasionally turning back to catch a second glimpse, only to let go because it's not our time yet, never our time."
"How many years, Raoul?"
This was the first time she'd used his name. It pleased him and it moved him.
"How many? I don't want to tell you."
"Why not?"
"Too many.
Just tell me."
He hesitated for a moment.
324. 18 times 18 years.
"Will we keep missing each other?"
"One day when you're old and gray, you'll see a young man step out of a car, or walk up to your hotel lobby, or enter a concert hall, and you'll say, 'I know him. He's the man I met years ago at that hotel in southern Italy, who kept telling me he'd known me another lifetime ago.' It will be the young man in the picture, which is why I wanted you to keep it. I too will again and again run into you. But I'll be too old, or too young, or you'll be too old or too young. But that day will come, I promise, though I have no vision of what our planet will be like. I hate goodbyes, especially after today. You make me fear the years of loneliness awaiting me, or worse yet, that my life and 18 generations of my life will mean nothing. What do I do with these lifetimes? No one can wait this long. We are all of us condemned to loneliness. Each and every one of us. You die alone. I'll die alone. You yelled my name when the car fell. I call out yours each and every night of my life. At some point, fate will realign our calendars, and if we're lucky, we'll live 70 long years together. And then never again.
He knew he was tearing up, and so stopped talking.
Any idea what a privilege it was to have you for two lunches, to walk with you in the sun, to swim with you and let myself dream I was a young man again, eating fruit on the rock by the old lighthouse that isn't even there any longer?
What had you hoped might happen to us? She asked.
Nothing. I wanted you to love the young man I once was. I wanted you to look at me and tell me that you'd forgotten nothing, that you'd suffered for 40+ years without knowing you were suffering, that you couldn't have been more grateful I'd brought you back here.
Did you really have something to do with the boat? She asked.
Yes, he replied.
Will you let it go?
When do you want me to?
Friday. This gives us 2 days.
Two more lunches, two more walks to our beach, the rock, maybe the house again.
Then he asked because he had to ask.
Will you be on the boat when I let it go?
I don't know. Yes, no, I don't know.
You will have to be. But tomorrow, very early, I'd planned a small errand for us.
An errand?
I want to take you to the cemetery. I want to show you her grave. And as in the poem, we'll bring a nosegay of green holly and heather blossom.
Because?
Because it will be my way of closing the circle. At the very last minute, you will go back with your friends and perhaps not believe a word of what happened here. And looking back, call the whole thing an old man's bluff, an old man's fiction. But seeing the grave will etch me forever in your heart. I've loved only you, and will continue to love you long, long after I'm gone. In the years to come, I want you to return, most likely with your husband, your children, or come alone, yes, or come alone. I don't have descendants, so the house will be yours. I signed the deed 3 days ago. Only promise me one thing. Bury me near her.
He turned to her.
Aren't you cold? He finally asked.
Freezing, she replied.
He'd waited a lifetime to hear her say this word.
This has been an Audible original, produced by Audible Originals, written by Andre Aciman, performed by Eduardo Ballerini, executive producers Doug Stumpf and Chelsea Pita, acquisition and development Joanne Parrots, Vice President of Audible Studios, Mike Charzik. Editor-in-Chief, Audible Original Publishing, David Blum. Copyright 2019 by Andre Aciman. Sound recording copyright 2020 by Audible Originals, LLC.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.